Mr. Gibbs, reel two.
Operation Character was divided into four groups, named after various animals. Now, these were walrus, in which I took part, otter, hyena, and mongoose.
You were in group walrus. What did it consist of?
Well, it was the commanding officer was Lieutenant Colonel Tulloch, who was known to us as Pop. Altogether, there were several majors, I think four eventually, several captains and sergeants, also a group of Burmese sappers and miners, and various other Anglo-Burmese, and so on.
So how many in all did the group consist of? Approximately.
Well, eventually, we didn't all go in together. There were 22, not counting Burmese sappers and miners. I don't know how many of them there were, actually. That was a group of... So if we say 30, that may be about right. But later on, we were joined by a group of E-4s, which I'll tell you about later.
Did you all... Whereabouts did you assemble in India before you set off?
India? Well, we were in Calcutta somewhere, and in... And we took off from the airport at Jessore. But we didn't all go in together, as I've already said. Shall I... I better explain that, I think. Colonel Tulloch and a number of people, I think some... went in and with the more or less blind into Kareni Hill, and
how do you spell that?
Oh, sorry, K-R-E-N-N-I Hills, and they landed and they found that the dropping zone was not very satisfactory, and also I think they were a bit they were. I think they were seen by a local, so they, anyway, for some reason they moved away. We were due to go in several hours later. They'd gone in the afternoon. We went in the evening. When we arrived over the supposed dropping zone, there was nothing there. And after searching around, the pilot said they'd have to go back to India for because of, lack of petrol. So we arrived back in India. 2 days later, the same thing happened again. And it was only on the third attempt that we actually landed in Burma. This was...
Was this in the Kareni Hills?
Yes. I was the... there were eight of us in our lot. And we, because of the small dropping zone, we did it in two sticks of four, and I was the first of the second stick. And when I jumped, I realised that we jumped from a very considerable height. Oh, I think probably 2,000 feet, whereas normally one done it from 700 or 800. This means I drifted quite away from the zone. In fact, I landed in a tree. The parachute caught in the upper branches, and because the harness caught round my pistol, I was left suspended a few feet above the ground, and I couldn't get out. And then I heard voices, which didn't please me very much. But suddenly it all gave way, and I fell over on my back into a ditch, and lost my pistol, which was never found. I also broke my glasses. Anyway, I got the villagers led me back to the rest of the party, and it turned out that the advance party had had casualties. One of the Burmese had been strangled to death. So he'd landed in a tree. He'd been strangled to his kit coming up around his neck. It sounds as though he hadn't been properly fitted. And a Major Lewis we had, who was a very heavy man, about 16 stone, broken ankle. And it seems that he had the wrong size parachute.
Whereabouts are the Kurani Hills?
Well, I suppose you'd call it southern Burma.
Is that southeast or southwest?
Well, it's fairly close to Siam, or what used to be called Siam, now Thailand. On second thoughts, I would think it would be more correct to say that we were on the east side of central Burma, very close to Thailand.
What was the nature of the terrain?
Oh, extremely hilly, or even mountainous. Some of the peaks went up to 6,000 feet, and we did an awful lot of climbing in our operation.
What did the people in the area seem to be like? Were they friendly or not?
Oh yes, they sounded friendly, but yes, you have to realise they're extremely primitive. They were not Burmese in the normal sense. I mean, these were hill tribes, very lean, small, very fit, of course. And living in very, very primitive. I mean, all their houses were built of bamboo, with very rare exceptions. They lived on rice, chicken, and the odd pig, and that sort of thing.
What was their attitude towards the Japanese? Could you tell?
Well, they were definitely didn't like them, because the Japs had behaved very badly, I gathered, from what I'd heard. They certainly welcomed us, anyway.
Did they tell you any details about the behaviour of the Japanese?
Well, we certainly occasionally heard of things happening during our operation.
What type of things did you hear?
I feel it better to describe at the beginning because, what we were trying to do.
Yes, all right.
Well, the area which we were trying to control had one road in it, the Loikor to Boliki Road, which in fact was a lower standard than the poorest British road, just about usable by carts, I suppose, and heavy vehicles. And the British Army, the 14th Army, of course, by this time was well into Burma, and our operation was to ambush the Japanese with the help of the local people. And this is what we did. As soon as we got organised, we got large quantities of arms dropped in and armed the local people, who we called them levies. They all got paid small sums, and they were very enthusiastic. The operation as a whole was remarkably successful. Thousands of Japanese were killed by the various levies because they were demoralised and short of. A lot of them were sick and made short of ammunition and weapons, and it was something you could call it murder. This went very, very smoothly for some weeks. We were not troubled by the Japanese at all. I should explain that as I was a radio operator, I only on one occasion took part in anything like this. I was regarded as sort of a obviously I was an essential part of the operation. If I'd got killed, it would have been very difficult. So that was the reason. But after some weeks, the Japanese got organised and they started to attack us in various ways. What we used to do was to cut and run. We didn't stick it out at all. Eventually, we we more or less all finished up in the same place. I'm not sure that anybody, all the groups gradually concentrated, there was the final attack by the Japanese, in which the levies, we found 149 dead bodies afterwards, all around. We were on a hill, and we were just watching it, really.
These were Japanese bodies, were they?
Japanese bodies, yes. And we estimated quite a lot of wounds as well. Oh, it's so routed, really. Well, somewhere about this time, Colonel Tullock, who was 54 then when he parachuted in, he was quite a remarkable man, really, because it's quite dangerous to do parachute jumping at that age. There's the risk of breaking a leg. But he thought that there were no Japanese worth mentioning between us and the British Army. And because I had direct radio contact with the 14th Army. And to prove it, he got a mule, and with a group of levies and other people, he went to the army 100 miles or so away, I bet it was, or might have been a bit more. And after a time, a week or so later, he sent for Captain Wilson, who was the officer I was with. I was with two officers, actually, Captain Wilson and Captain Steele, but he's to form one group. And he ordered Captain Wilson and myself to do the same thing, except we didn't have any mules. So we did this. Captain Wilson and I, as far as I can recall, we did it in about 5 days. We left on the 28th of July, 1945. We just walked through. Of course, the terrain became a bit flatter and full of paddy fields, whereas we'd had very hilly country, and this was quite different. And we always used to find we got leeches on our feet or on our legs at night and had to get rid of them. On the 30th, I celebrated my 28th birthday on the course of this, and eventually we arrived and joined up with the 14th Army on the 2nd of August.
What was the name of the place that you joined up with them at?
I can tell you in a moment if I can just... yes, on the 2nd of August, we reached Thidgit, which is spelled T-H-I-G-Y-I-T, and contacted the East Yorks Regiment. Incidentally, I went swimming, and I lost my last pair of army spectacles. I'd had three pairs, and they'd all got broken or lost. And this is really the end. Eventually, I arrived in Mektilla. And I was flown out to Rangoon in an L5 plane, a very light plane, literally made of canvas and metal framing with two seats. And eventually I got to Calcutta. And that was, of course, the end as far as I was concerned. Why Colonel Tullock sent for us, I'm not quite clear, because, in fact, we didn't do anything. Whether he was trying to prove his... again, that it was easy to do, I don't know, but I have no record that I ever did anything in the way of... I may have done some radio work, but I don't think I did, but certainly not very much.
When you were operating the radio in Burma, what were the differences, the technical differences, as far as you were concerned, in operating the radio in Burma, as compared with operating it in Europe?
I think the sets were similar, as far as I can recall. The difference was that we very quickly had steam generators, which used wood for fuel and, of course, water. And which were not very reliable. They tended to go wrong, break, and also later on we got petrol generators. Again, sometimes we didn't have any petrol. And all sorts of things went wrong, minor things, but we always seemed to have managed to cope with it in some way.
How did this steam generator system work?
How did it work?
Yes.
Well, it was just a steam engine working a generator. I can't remember any more about it than that.
How big was the steam engine?
Well, not very big, I don't think. I can't remember, but it certainly one didn't have to be very big, did it? It didn't have to be great power. It just had to turn a dynamo or full dynamo. Just to keep battery charged.
So this was dropped.
We had batteries as well. Usually rather similar to a car battery. And
so the steam generator was dropped in with you into Burma.
Yes, not immediately. I don't think. I think to start off with, we had hand generators, but we got steam generators later.
Did it run on wood or?
Yes.
What?
Well, the fuel was wood. Yes. Well, there's nothing else. Well, any coal.
And what about the question of reception in Burma?
Oh, well, we all these villages had somebody called a headman who would have who would receive us in his hut. And we used to drink kaungye, which is a sort of beer made with fermented rice. And you have a bamboo pot full of fermented rice and you put boiling water on it and then you pass it round. It's a very sociable thing. You have another thin bit of bamboo, as a sort of a drinking straw, really, and just pass it round, and you suck it up and you against your teeth so that the rice doesn't go into your mouth, and pass it on. And there was also a spirit called zoo, which was made out of the same, by distilling this beer in some way.
What was it called?
Zoo, Z-U, Z-Zoo. Well, perhaps I should mention that we'd also that in the course of the operation we met a group of people from what was called E Force, who had been dropped in to look for prisoner war camps, and they hadn't found the area, so they joined up with us. This was led by a Captain Lockett, who'd been Wingate's ADC. General Wingate, who chinned it, so you read about. He was rather a mad character. And in fact, he was invalided out with cirrhosis of the spine. He had the radio op he had with a Sergeant Gallia, and they didn't get on very well together. They hadn't really got acquainted, and Sergeant Gallia was a fairly uncouth character and not very well educated, and there was a lot of friction. In fact, Sergeant Gallia was actually put on a charge because he was rather, he went tearing after the Japs on one occasion, and in fact he was reduced to the rank of signalman by a Major Bowl who was in our group, but this was overturned by Colonel Tullock. He remained a sergeant. Captain Lockett was invalided out. He was taken out by a light plane during the operation, before I left. And I would have thought he hadn't long to live, but in fact he got an obituary in the Times in 1960, which was written by Colonel Tullock. And I've got it if you want. I have it if you wish to see it sometime.
What was the nature of the quarrel between Lockett and Gallia?
Well, there wasn't any quarrel. It was just that Gallia would answer Lockett rather rudely. Captain Lockett never called him Sergeant. He, you know, it was customary in the army, of course, to refer to people by their rank, and he would call him Gallia, which was, of course, quite improper. And the funny thing was that after he'd been put on, you know, the orders. Captain Lockett started calling him Sergeant when he'd theoretically been reduced to signalman.
Did they manage to discover any POWs?
No, they didn't. No, that was the whole point. That's why they there weren't any in our area, as far as we knew. So they joined up with us.
How long were they with you? Do you know?
Well, I can tell you the date that they actually we found them. I think we contacted Captain Lockett about the 24th of May, I beg your pardon, 24th of April, about a month after we'd parachuted in ourselves.
How did you meet them? How did you come across them? Can you describe the meeting?
Well, I don't know personally. I assume that some villagers told us they were quite near us and we went to meet them, but I can't remember the details now.
How many of them were there in EFOS?
Four, I think. Yes, that's right. Captain Lockett, Sergeant Gallia, a Burmese called Maung Tin, another Burmese called Paul Shiswe, C-H-I-S-W-E. I think he was known as Paul Chiswick, actually, afterwards, but I think he was Anglo-Burmese.
What equipment did they have with them, these people in EFOS? Were they well armed?
I don't think they'd been well armed. I suppose they would have had their personal weapons. I wouldn't have been able to carry it around because I don't think they had any local people with them. As we were able to arm large numbers of people, and we always had people. We paid people to carry our equipment, and possibly they did too. But I wouldn't have thought they'd been very well armed, just enough to cope for themselves, personal weapon, which was a carbine. We all had carbines and pistols as well.
British carbines?
Well, I'm not certain about that. I think they probably were, but I wouldn't be quite sure.
You said that you armed the villagers.
Yes.
Were you receiving constant drops of arms then?
Oh, yes.
How successful were those drops?
Well, you mean stuff being lost and that
yes.
kind of thing? I think they were very successful on the whole, but of course things did go astray and things got smashed and all that sort of thing.
And you were just having carbines dropped in, were you, for the villagers?
Oh, no, they had rain guns and all sorts of things, mortars, I think, and I suppose rifles.
So was there a mass training program for them to learn how to use them?
Well, I suppose there must have been, but I've no personal recollection of it. I mean, I was concerned, as I say, it was doing coding, and which took a fair amount of time, and radio operating.
And did you have large quantities of money with you to pay them?
Oh, yes. Large quantities, and for our own personal use, in fact, so that our personal pay just mounted up in India. We didn't have to draw any pay at all.
What kind of money were you using?
Well, I think they were Indian rupees, mostly, as far as I can recall. Paper money, of course, probably not worth very much, but they are. I think we used silver rupee quite a lot. Some of the payments were made in silver rupees, as far as I can recall, but I'm very unsure about that.
Was there ever any dispute with the villagers about payment or anything else?
Yes. Well, we had one rather bad example. I was with at one stage, soon after we arrived, we decided to blow up this road, which I've mentioned, the Loy Kaur Balaki Road, and we had a vast amount of explosives dropped. I think it was 2,500 pounds, and Sergeant Carroll and myself were detailed to take this explosive from the place where it was parachuted in to a certain point near the road, and we had something like 70 bearers, because we had I think 50 of them or so carrying the explosive, and then we had people carrying equipment and batteries and all sorts of things, you know. Sergeant Carroll was in the front, and I was at the back to make sure that nobody dropped out. In fact, I had to fire a shot when we moved off in the morning, when everybody moved off, and I suddenly found there were four people missing, and we couldn't stop including absolutely essential equipment, radio. So anyway, they were sleeping at the other end of the village. Anyway, we got this sorted out, and so we carried on, and it was all right. But at a certain point, all these bearers suddenly refused to go any further, and the reason apparently was that they'd been told they were going to a certain place, and there was some misunderstanding, I assume. I don't know precisely. And Sergeant Carroll had a very bright idea. He spoke Burmese to some extent. He was a very odd character, a very rough sort of character, but he spoke Burmese. And he got a mound of earth and put a small amount, I think about 1 ounce of explosive and a bit of a fuse. And he said to the Japs, to the villagers, this is what we're going to do to the Japs. And this is the village where we were. And, of course, blew up this mound of earth, and immediately all the villagers picked up these, packs of explosive and what have you, and carried on. So we had a sort of, you could say, we had a bit of a strike, and which luckily was solved. But it was a very, while it lasted, it was a very depressing time. Yeah.
What was the name of
but
this
But I don't road? Recall any other trouble.
What was the name of this road?
The road?
Yes.
Well, Loy Kaw, it's Loikaw, one end, and these are two towns on the road, and the other one was Bolaki, which is spelled Bawlake. I'm not saying the road stopped at, these towns. In fact, it was just two towns on a long road, and we were controlling that area.
So, were the Japanese in control of the two towns at either end of the road?
I think they were probably in Loy Kaw. I don't know about Bolaki. We certainly heard at various times they were in Loy Kaw.
You said that you were on one of the operations.
Mm.
Which operation were you on?
Well, it was... There was no risk to it because we were on a considerable distance away. We were on a hill, possibly half a mile or even perhaps a little bit more, away from a certain point which we knew to be a sort of staging camp for the Japs. And we saw them arrive. We just fired a lot of rounds into a wood where we could see they were at. But Wok and I took part in this. And we did this for about a minute or so. And they beat it, and eventually they started firing mortars at us, but...